Honeywood Reel 1. Now, can we start off by thinking about this period when you were at Downside and Buckfast as a Benedictine monk? This was a period between 1909 and 1912. What interests me is to have some idea of the sort of life you had as a Benedictine monk under the Cistercian rules. What was the kind of pattern of life there?
Well, the Buckfast rule at that time was the same as the Cistercian rule, which meant perpetual silence, except once a week when we were allowed to talk for an hour, so you can imagine what that was like. Entirely prayer, no meat, no fish, eggs on feast days, otherwise prayer and work, farm work. We had a big farm there.
I wonder if with only 1 hour's conversation a week you kind of lost the habit of conversation.
Yes, one rarely talked nonsense, I think, because one slept on three boards with a bit of straw on the top. One was up at 2 o'clock in the morning for the first service, matins.
Do you think that period of life, of your life, influenced your life as a whole?
I think, yes, I do. It certainly helped to keep me straight. I think I should probably have been an absolute rotter if I hadn't had it, I think.
You told me that, I think during the period you were there, or maybe it was a little bit after, that the Cistercian rule ended. What followed it, and why did the change?
Well, the rule that they had then appeared to be too strict for the average Englishman, too hard. Most of the monks were German, and a few French. And then, after the First War, they were all interned in their monastery during the First War. And after the First War, it was thought that things should be made easier. And then, some years afterwards, they were transferred from one congregation, if you understand what I mean by that, to another. They were transferred to the English congregation, which had a less strict rule. In other words, they can talk, they can eat meat, they can eat fish, they can do anything like that. And the English congregation runs schools. Entirely a different life.
I wonder why there was felt to be any need to intern the monks during the war. Were they regarded as some kind of potential?
They were German. For the majority were German, you see. But they were only interned in their own monastery.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't allowed out off their own grounds.
Yeah. Now, after you left the monastery, you spent a couple of years in France and England, when one of your main interests was motorcycling.
Yes.
I'm interested in the kind of machines that you rode at the time.
Well, the one that I rode most in England was a Red Indian, which of course was then a very, very popular machine, 8-horse. But the one I won the Nice La Turbie race in France on was what they call a Williamson, which was a Douglas 8-horse engine, water-cooled, a very, very heavy machine.
Can you remember any details of the race?
Oh, I remember that one very specially, because the Nice La Turbie, it's the most terrific hill climb and very dangerous. I mean, almost hairpin bends going up it.
Were there any particular incidences during the race that you can recall?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
The large picture appeared as an advertisement in the French papers of W. Honeywood becomes vient de remporter une éclatante victoire. It was a great victory on the Williamson.
In this period before the First World War, was there much of a motorcycling fraternity?
Yes, there was. There were all kinds of little meetings all over the country. But it was rather, I don't know, it was a specialist thing, I suppose. Of course, a motorbike in those days didn't cost more than £40, at the most, the best ones.
Were there any kinds of associations that you joined to keep within the motorcycling fraternity?
One belonged to various things. I can't remember what they were, but I mean, we had one club which used to meet at, what's the name of the place, Brooklands. And then there were meetings all over the country.
And you raced at Brooklands as well, did you?
Yes, in a small way.
Mm-hmm. What was Brooklands like before the war, and can you tell me?
Oh, it was just like a huge great bowl made of concrete. Very high walls, which occasionally people went over, incidentally. When I say walls, I mean the...
This was banking.
Banking.
Yeah.
Yes, there were. I think they were just starting a few aeroplanes, trying to start aeroplanes there, as far as I can remember. I remember going down to Brooklands on one occasion, the only time I ever appeared in the police court for myself. I got fined 5 shillings for going more than 20 miles an hour.
That's a very nice story. Can you remember any of the competitions at Brooklands that you took part in? What were the sort of features?
I don't remember any especially, no.
Okay.
They were all small things.
Mm. Now, in 1914, you volunteered, joined the army on the outbreak of war. I wonder whether your religious background created any sort of moral problems or moral dilemmas for you.
In joining
about,
the army?
About joining the army, taking up arms.
No, like no, not at all. Not at all. In fact, I was so keen, I was frightened that it'd be over before I got out there.
Mm-hmm. Why did you join up for 7 years rather than...
There was no other way of doing it then. You see, Kitchener's army hadn't started. That didn't start till later on. And 7 years was the minimum you could join for. Anyhow, I should have done it, I think. Anyhow, I don't know. Didn't think about it.
Now, you joined the 17th King's Own Lancers.
Not King's Own, 17th Duke of Cambridge's Own.
Ah. Why that particular regiment?
Well, I think probably the badge, the skull and crossbones, may have done a lot. And, of course, the fact that the regiment led the charge at Balaclava, which naturally made one proud of it. I don't think anything else. I was determined to go into cavalry. I mean, I'd been riding all my childhood days.
Mm-hmm. Now, having taken the decision to join up, you then went and joined up, and this... Was at Marylebone Town Hall?
Yes, at Marylebone Town Hall.
He described for me the sort of scene at Marylebone Town Hall when you went along to...
Well, there were dozens of people, in fact, I should think 50 or 60 people trying to get in. And then one was asked, when one did get in after a long time, one was asked what one wanted to join and that kind of thing. Mm. One didn't take the shilling there. We took that later on at St. Martin's in the Fields when we were moved on down there behind the railings.
Tell me about that. What was the sort of scene at St. Martin's in Field when you
went
down?
Well, we were
there?
All put there in behind the railings outside the church, and everybody came to look at us like a lot of monkeys. kind people put things through the bars for us. We were kept there. We took the first shilling. Of course, it was only a shilling a day pay in those days, which I lost, incidentally, before I left there. I don't know what happened to it. But
was there much enthusiasm and excitement amongst the crowd that you
were with? Oh, yes, everybody. Mm-hmm. Terrific enthusiasm. Everybody wanting to get to the war as quickly as they could.
After St. Martin's in the Fields, you went along to Woolwich Barracks for equipment and some training.
Yes, well, really we did very little training because there were too many people there. I mean, I don't know how many there were, but it must run into thousands.
Tell me about this. How able was this centre to receive the kind of influx?
Well, it wasn't ready in the slightest degree. I mean, they equipped us as far as clothing went with much difficulty. Many of us had to sleep out in the grounds outside the barracks, the rest on the floors in the barrack rooms. No beds or anything like that. There was about one plate and one mug for probably 20 people. We had to buy our own if we could. There's absolutely no arrangement really made at all. Typically English.
You've mentioned the barracks were crowded at Woolwich.
Yes.
What was the sort of scene inside the barracks? How did you manage living there?
Oh, we managed. About everybody was mucking in, as you might say. And we all got on well together. Everybody, every class of person, including jailbirds who had been sent by the judges or the magistrates as part of their punishment to go into the army, which used to be done in those days.
I suppose this scene at Woolwich illustrates how unprepared Britain was to react quickly.
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so.
Now, after this short period of just a couple of weeks at Woolwich, you went on to the Curragh to really get your training underway.
Yes, we were put into a cattle ship and taken over to Ireland, and then on to the Curragh, where we joined what was then known, I think I'm right in saying, as the 8th Cavalry Reserve. I may be wrong there, but I think it was the 8th.
What was the Curragh like when you got there?
Curragh, a wonderful place, really. All troops, of course, thousands of them there. It was a regular troops establishment, of course.
Now, you trained as a cavalry trooper, and I think that sort of builds up an impression of a training which is primarily with sword and lance and horse. I wonder, was much time and importance attached to rifle training?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did all our rifle training and Lewis gun training. Of course, riding school, lance drill, sword drill.
I wonder if you became as proficient with the rifle as, say, the infantry soldier.
Oh, very much so. In fact, in years after, I used to shoot at Bisley regularly.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the kind of recruits that you were rubbing shoulders with at this very early stage of the war.
Well, a thorough mixture. All damn good fellows. I think the one I especially remember, I won't mention names, was a professional pickpocket. And he and I made very great friends. We were in the same troop. And he used to try and teach me to pickpockets, but I was never very successful at it, I'm afraid. The great thing about those people, of course, is they'll never pickpockets or do any harm to their own pals. In other words, to anybody serving with them. this man, he's quite well off, really, from his pickpocketing. And I promised to go and see him after the war was over. But actually, the last thing I heard of him was he'd hit a sergeant in the face and he'd gone to jail. But I don't know what happened. He wasn't living in the place he told me he was going to be in when I did go down there, so I never saw him again. But there were mixtures of all kinds, all classes, and everybody mucked in together.
I imagine that this kind of mixture of people from varieties of backgrounds must have been an interesting situation from the point of view of sort of breaking down social class barriers.
Oh, very. There were no barriers, no barriers at all.
Now, after the Curragh, you moved on to Bisley in the beginning of 1915, having been commissioned into the Motor Machine Gun Service.
That's right. I was commissioned to the MMGS, as they called it. No, go on.
I was going to say, was it easy to get a commission?
Oh, yes. Anybody with education. And recommended, of course, by the colonel of whoever you were with. I actually was recommended by Colonel Portal of the 17th, who was commanding the depot at that time.
I wonder whether this process of instantly commissioning civilians with no military background, whether that created any problems for sort of military efficiency.
It must have done to a point, but on the other hand, there were a hell of a lot of people going about who were born leaders, and that was the thing they were looking for. People who could lead. Didn't matter if you didn't know your sword drill so much.